Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome along to the Alice Worsley Show with you till 1:30 this afternoon. And the whole of this time is actually taken up with a very special guest that I had a chance to interview a month or so ago when he came through New Zealand to promote two books. The first book is American Scoundrel, Murder, Love and Politics in Civil War America by Thomas Keneally. Now, Thomas Keneally is the author of many great books, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, which was turned into an excellent movie, and Schindler's Ark, which was also turned into a superb movie by Steven Spielberg and became Schindler's List. Well, his first book we're going to talk about today is American Scoundrel, and he's also written another superb book called Bettany's Book. So let's catch up with the wonderful Thomas Keneally. Thomas, your latest book, American Scoundrel, is about a man called Dan Sickles. Now, how did you first hear of this man?
There was a particular Irish nationalist convict who was sent to Van Diemen's Land for the big one, high treason, for life. And he was quite a famous, internationally known political prisoner. His name was Thomas Francis Maher, M-E-A-G-H-E-R. And in 1852, he escaped on an American ship to New York, and he had quite a stellar career. He was admitted to the bar, he edited a newspaper, he became a Union general, he became governor of Montana, and there, before he could become a U.S. senator, which he would have become, he was killed by Republican vigilantes. Now, he had a friend in the 1850s in Tammany Hall, the Democrat machine in New York, a man called Dan Sickles. Sickles became a congressman, and one day on the eve of the Civil War, he shot his wife's lover dead right outside the White House in front of many witnesses, and he was the subject of possibly one of the most famous trials in history, actually, because he pled temporary insanity, and he was the first person in history to make a plea of temporary insanity. And Thomas Francis Maher from Tasmania, the undischarged British felon, was one of his dream team of lawyers. And I just loved that, you know, that appealed to my idea of subversion. But he then survived this famous trial. He got off, and the result was that he was left to redeem himself, and redeemed himself through the Civil War. His poor wife was not permitted to redeem herself and died of tuberculosis. So in their different ways, the two of them are lenses upon their age, and a proof that the old right-wing idea that there are traditional values to which we should return, this book tends to show that we always mucked up. That we're a good species for mucking up.
So you obviously felt there was a real book about this man. But how do you begin to find out about a man who is dead and all living relatives have gone, so they can't tell you the little bits of gossip? How do you go about researching a man like Dan Sickles?
Well, fortunately, in the New York Public Library are his letters, and in the Historical Society of New York, and in the Library of Congress, his letters and Teresa's letters, and so you can research them through the two of them through these letters. Also, because their love and then their scandal over her lover and the fact that he shot the lover dead, that is heavily recorded. The transcript of the trial exists, so generally there's a great deal of material on the two of them in these, particularly in New York, and a lot of rare 19th century books in which they appear, and people's opinions about them appear. So it was relatively joyful and easy to research them, given that the material was so centralized. One had to read a lot about their background, and fortunately contemporary writers, when writing about New York, often mentioned Sickles and mentioned the young wife and then the tragedy of the young wife. And of course then there are the War Department records in which he's mentioned, because as part of his redemption he became a very important general. And when his leg was crushed at Gettysburg by a cannonball and was amputated, it was placed in a little coffin all of its own and taken off to Washington, where it is on display to this day. I gave a reading from the book at the Smithsonian recently, a couple of weeks ago, and a number of people told me that to prepare themselves for the lecture, they had visited Dan's leg that very day. It's in the museum attached to the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. So these were some of the things that attracted me to Dan, but in particular the tragedy of the young wife, who was really a good girl. She could be accused of a certain foolishness and a certain susceptibility to older men, but she was uncomplaining with her fate, which was to be kind of depravity on a statue. She was depicted by the age as a depraved woman. Her confession to her crimes was printed, and it was considered a form of pornography, her confession. She mentioned nakedness and doing what evil women do. And this poor kid, she was at that stage barely 20, and that marked her for the rest of her life. Now, the sins of women, if you look at what's her name, the woman, Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
The famous Monica Lewinsky, she's still going to pay the larger price for her folly than the man. But in the 19th century, the scales were tilted far more against the woman.
Let's talk about the man there, because I want to talk about Mr. Sickles. He was a real womanizer, and not just once, but many times over. And this poor woman, she lives a life sort of behind closed doors after her little misdemeanor, but he got away with it time after time.
Yes,
after time.
Indeed, it's interesting that he's pleading temporary insanity for the first time in history. Now, if someone pleaded temporary insanity these days, his own behavior, whether he must be behave with other women, would be germane to the case of whether he was subject to an uncontrollable moral rage. But not in those days. He had in fact committed adultery at least twice that month with a woman in Baltimore, and hotel records showed that. But that wasn't considered admissible by the judge, because the wife was considered part of the security of the household. She sat at the center of the home, and the husband, whatever his behavior, personal behavior, was entitled to her inviolability. And that idea was very strong, so that one of Dan's lawyers, who would later become Secretary for War under Lincoln, Edwin Stanton, one of Dan's lawyers said, both the good and the bad man are entitled to the inviolability of the wife. And Thomas Francis Marr, writing a brilliant speech which was delivered for the defense, Thomas Francis Marr, the former Australian convict, said the wife should be guaranteed, her inviolability should be guaranteed in the same sense that the inviolability of the household itself and of the hospitable roof is guaranteed. So the wife was to an extent considered a piece of movable property to whose inviolability, since she gave birth to the children, you were entitled. You were entitled that she would give birth to your children, not somebody else's, and that she would not contract a social disease, a sexually transmitted disease, from a lover. You were entitled to all that.
She might get it from her husband, though, judging by the way he slept around.
Yes, she could get it from Dan Sickles. And indeed, Lincoln was always worried before he was married that he might have a sexually transmitted disease. He may have had one. There are only two recorded resources that dear old Abe Lincoln had to prostitutes, and yet he was worried that he'd caught something, you know.
The interesting thing is, though, Tom, that he actually went to England to visit Queen Victoria, but he didn't take his dear wife. He took instead with him a mistress and a prostitute by the name of Fanny White, if I remember rightly.
Yes, Fanny was a very entrepreneurial young madam and was for many years his mistress, and Teresa had just given birth to, at the age of 16, to their daughter Laura, and Dan decided to take Fanny with him, and Fanny put her establishment under the care of another entrepreneurial prostitute and went to London with him, but expressed the desire to meet the Queen. So he passed her off, Dan did, as a New York socialite called Miss Bennett, and she got to see this sort of pillar of probity, of monogamy, and then of a pious widowhood. And again, it's typical of him that he would behave with such recklessness, because at the time he had the job from the American government of persuading the governments of Europe that it was right and appropriate for the United States to acquire Cuba. And he was involved in a lot of shuttle diplomacy, trying to persuade the French, the Spanish, to, well, in the case of the Spanish should yield up Cuba. And it's interesting how Cuba still bedevils the United States the way it did then. So on the one hand, he had this job designed for a statesman and requiring statesmanship, and on the other, he was utterly reckless. And that was characteristic of his life. It was characteristic of his crime. He went from shooting Philip Barton Key dead to being very composed and walking round to the Attorney General's house and turning himself in and sitting down discussing the fate of the Democratic Party in the upcoming Pennsylvania election. So he combined extremes of passion with extremes of calmness, and extreme political cunning with utter recklessness.
And he lived till over 90.
And he knew Mark Twain, but he rarely wore a prosthesis. He wanted America to know that he'd given his leg for them. So in case anyone ever mentioned Philip Barton Key, the man he'd shot. Now, the interesting thing about Philip Barton Key was that he was the son of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the American National Anthem. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light, etc., etc. And hence he had to sit through or stand through many recitals and recitations of the Star Spangled Banner, but it never struck him with guilt. He always stood there on his one leg, and his situation was, if I shot Philip Barton Key dead and killed the DNA of the national anthem, nonetheless I gave my leg for the Republic. So that Mark Twain said of him when he was old, when Dan was old, that of the two legs the old general had at one time possessed, he favoured the one he'd lost over the one he still retained.
He's a fascinating man, isn't he? Who do you think will enjoy reading your book? Because it's not fiction as such. It's a non-fiction book.
No, but I tried to write it with a novelist's taste for character and narrative pace. And the fact that Dan is so outrageous, and that poor Teresa's life is such a tragedy after she is found, she is exposed through the trial. His lawyers destroyed her to save him. Hope that readers will be as delighted as I was with the material. He's a novel almost begging to be written, but the reason I didn't write him as a novel is that it would have been a very, very long novel, and it would have meant going into the turning Lincoln and his wife into characters, because the thing he used to do with Lincoln's wife was he'd accompany her to seances and keep an eye on her, because there were all these crazy mediums throughout Washington. There were so many young men dying, and in those days so many children died anyhow. Mrs. Lincoln lost two of her children in childhood, and she was full of an inconsolable grief, and Dan used to take her to all these charlatans who'd put her in contact with her children, and that was one of the jobs he did for the Lincoln family, for which Abraham Lincoln was very grateful. He also got her out of embezzlement charges, as I relate in the book, and that made Lincoln again very grateful to him, so that he could come and go in the White House and tell Lincoln off, and it was an extraordinary role that he played in the Lincoln household and in Mary Todd Lincoln's life. So altogether there's this combination of huge influence, of huge historic importance, with all this rascality and embezzlement. And of course he was in charge of the left wing of the Union Army at Gettysburg, and there too his actions are very controversial to this day, although I was surprised to find that I had great sympathy for what he did that day. He was a very brave officer, and that's why Lincoln loved him. So was Thomas Francis Maher, the escaped Australian convict who raised the Irish Brigade. 5,000 Irishmen who were used as shock troops again and again kept on getting killed over and over. He'd re-recruit his brigade, Thomas Francis Maher. Both he and Sickles found that they liked war, and that the strongest associations they had were with their young men. They were not old men and they were generals, and they had these intense relationships with their officers and with their men. And it's interesting that Sickles' men always loved him, and that his chaplains, the Irish Jesuit, the famous Reverend Twitchell, who became a friend of Mark Twain, and various other clergymen who served in his Third Corps, all loved him, you know. And so, you know, they forgave him his sins the way the Jews forgave Oscar Schindler's sins, because they felt, well, if he wasn't that sort of man in the bedroom, he wouldn't be this sort of man on the factory floor or this sort of man on the battlefield. And the huge level of acceptance amongst other men. Even in 1900, when Teresa was long dead of her shame and her tuberculosis, he sent a boa constrictor to the Reverend Twitchell as a gift, because what the one-legged Dan was always doing was going off for adventures to South America, both political adventures and finding animals for the Central Park Zoo. So he would, for example, when he fell in love late in life with an artist called the Countess Palahi, a Hungarian artist, and he paid her bill for her to stay in the Plaza Hotel, and it very quickly mounted to $5,000. He was her guarantor. But she expressed a desire to have tiger cubs. Unfortunately, a tigress had just given birth in the Central Park Zoo, so he brought these two tiger cubs round to be with her in the plaza. He was outrageous character. But
I can see a movie in this too, you know.
Well, it's interesting you can say that. We didn't discuss this before we started talking, but Francis Ford Coppola has been trying to make a film on Sickles for some time, and he has a brilliant screenplay by Norman Mailer and his wife, Norris Church Mailer. And now he's hoping he'll be able to use American scoundrel to get the film off the ground again, which is great news if it comes off for the Keneally Old Age Fund, old age fast descending upon me. But he recently, or the people at Zoetrope, which is Ford's company, gave me Mailer's screenplay, and I liked it very much. I thought, you know, you've always got a few ideas about a screenplay. So they said, will you write to Norman Mailer and tell him what you think the revision should be? Now, that's a bit like writing to God and revising the Old Testament. So I did write a wimpish letter that said, you know, perhaps you would consider changing this, or one could perhaps say, or one could perhaps include the notion that. And so I'm hopeful that there'll be a film. It's going to be a difficult film to make, though, because of the problem of deciding what to put in and what to leave out. The Schindler film was equally unwieldy, but at least Schindler had the good grace to die about the age of 66 instead of living as long as Dan.
That's right.
To the eve of World War One.
Now, I noticed that on your CV it actually includes a couple of acting parts. One was in The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. Mm. So I thought maybe you could have a word to Francis Ford Coppola and see if you can get a little walk-on part in Dan Sickles' movie.
Well, you know, I tried to get a part in Jurassic Park. Not because I'm an old dinosaur, but that is partly true. But what I found wrong with Jurassic Park was that the old Attenborough figure was too nice and cuddly a figure to have really created all this mayhem. And I thought there must be an evil brother, and that I could be this evil brother. And I suggested it to Spielberg's people at Amblin, and they didn't buy it. So my attempt to get back into acting was thwarted. And I still don't believe the proposition of Jurassic Park, that dear old Attenborough, which one is it of the
it's
two?
It's Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough. That I get him mixed up with his naturalist brother or cousin, that Richard Attenborough was too nice to be responsible for all this Jurassic mayhem.
Well, look, I'm going to get on the phone to Francis Ford Coppola. I can't pull any clout, I must admit, but I'll have a word and say that I think that you would be wonderful in the movie on Dan Sickles' life. I'm not too sure which part.
Edward Stanton, maybe.
Okay.
He was a little squirt with a bald head, too.
Okay, you're on. Right. Okay. Good luck for that, Tom, and
okay.
Thanks for joining me today.
Not at all.